pack my tails in a whistle and blow them all away. What if I've been unlucky, really haven't a thing? There's a time I always feel happy as a king. When the red robin comes bob, bob, bobbing along, along, there'll be no more sobbing when he stops robbing his own. So, wake up, you sleepyhead, get up, get out of bed, cheer up, the sun is red, live, love, laugh and be happy. What if I've been blue, now I'm walking through fields of flowers, rain makes little, but still I listen for hours.
You're listening to Adams, Motion and the Void. There is an old map of Lemon pinned to the bathroom wall of my cabin, and it was there when I moved in. It shows the contours of the local ranges and the trickling valley streams. It is also spotted with the turquoise smudgings of seven lakes, and I have located all but one of these, which bears the curious name of Minishing Lake. While Minishing Lake appears to be located at the northern edge of Lemon, perhaps a half mile in from the largely disused turnpike, which thereafter threads northward to Canada, I have not yet been able to find it. I have gone several times into the region, but have not found any approach road, nor view of the lake, nor has wandering into the woods been fruitful, nor does anyone in town quite seem to recall it. Aside from its being quite large, and quite near civilization, while not yet being interesting enough to qualify for a road or any public viewing, the most striking thing about Minishing Lake is its shape, for it appears to form the figure of the letter M. As it is like a tender bread, all too ready to disintegrate, I have never taken the old map down, and it is possible that I am not quite following its symbolic instruction. My method is to visit the map and commit what I can of the cartographic elements to memory before setting out in the car. Aside from the unfindable lake, another micro-curiosity has developed. On each of my expeditions in search of the lake, I have noticed something in the manner of a strange cord going fully over the road near an abandoned trailer home. It is the sort of rubber, hose-like cable that gas stations used to place near their full-service pumps that dinged when a customer's car had rolled into gas-filling position. It was early afternoon when I set out, and maybe only 5 minutes later, I was pulling onto the sandy shoulder about 50 yards past the trailer. The cord, I saw, went snaking up into the woods toward the home, and as I strolled up the unused dirt driveway, I quickly gathered from its empty and useless face, and from the black, gaping space where the front door used to be, that it was not inhabited. The silver roof was covered in a debris of needles, leaves, and sticks, and the white plastic siding was engrimed and spattered with mold. Yet, however, I noticed that the black cord continued further along this way through the woods and was tucked, I could see now, directly around the trailer's cinder block foundation. As I came around the rear, I found a smashed-up spindling of TV antennas stacked on a rotting wooden cable spool, around which, in a mix of weeds and shadows, was a scatter of well-worn tires. The black cord, I saw, was plugged into an external socket. I don't know why I did not recognize it sooner as a power cord, but I have always had difficulty recognizing things out of context. There were cobwebs inside the glassy head of the electric meter, but I could see the surprising fact of the spinning heliostat. The trailer was long abandoned, but someone, or something, was still sipping its electricity. And as I crossed back over the road on the far side, following after the black extension cord and into the woods, I began to suppose that following the cord would bring me, somehow, to the M-shaped lake. Thereupon, within me was a kind of granular and simple awareness that following the leads of any one mystery will naturally marry up into another, and thereafter be married into all the rest, until one was struck to realize that all mysteries were at the same time of different form, but sharing the same heart. I lifted the extension cord, and it slid through my hand like a snake-like piece of luggage as I began to make my way into the forest. The further along I followed the cord, the harder the travel became. The trees were mostly pine, and my green view was one of increased blockage. After 30 minutes, the earth grew soft and damp beneath my feet, and rising from this swampland was a sharp, bridling thicket of thorns and briars. To avoid the thorns, I made little outward loops away from the extension cord, and it was because of the increase in my concentration on the terrain and vicious foliage, I suppose, that I did not notice the white gesture of smoke creeping through the branches overhead. It was only when I heard the crackle of the fire that I finally looked up and saw the watery, orange fan of flames. I startled back, thinking this some wildfire, but quickly understood that it was contained. The fire, in fact, was on a small sandy beach, and I was struck to note that I had arrived at my lake. I was gazing along the narrow channel of what I imagined was one of Minishing Lake's long legs. The pyre was neatly arranged into a pyramidal form by means of 3 inwardly leaned masts. Around these the fire maker had woven out a huge nest of young green branches, which crackled and smoked with sap. I stepped onto the beach and drew close to the fire pit, and felt its vibrant heat on my face and body. To my left, the peninsula narrowed to a distant point, at the far tip of which I could see a small, brown log home. Attending nearby the cottage, there was a canoe and a dock and a variety of tools and furnishings. The wind began to lob toward me, and the smoke shifted, and my eyes watered. I made a circuit around the pit to escape the corrosive smoke. On the far side, facing the water, I came upon an inviting log whose top surface had been planed into a bench for sitting. Next to the log was a stack of neatly folded clothing. On top of the log was a dilapidated book. It was a messy pile of pages with a rotten spine held together by twine. The cover, however, read, "Signaling for Guidance," and the subtitle was, "A Guide to the Wise Use of Spirit Fire." I do not know why these clear signs did not force my appreciation of a nearby person, but there was something so rustic and anachronistic about this spectacle that I had not yet come into proper step with time. "Go back in the woods!" a female voice suddenly cried. I turned around quickly to regard the water, and did not at first see the speaker, there being a camouflage of lily pads and tall smooth stones in the shallow inlet. But I finally saw, in a frog-like aspect, along the water top, a set of eyes goggling me. "Hello," I called. "I am Sherwin Sleeves. I find that when I am put out, or frightened, that I will utter my own name as though it alone were the key to safety." The woman now surfaced, or at least stood tall enough that I might see her face and the beginnings of her upper torso. She dropped back down in the water and swam to her side. "Ah," I said, "I follow. You are unclothed, and here I am." I turned my back uncertainly. I was reluctant to go back into the thick woods. Get on up to the cabin, she said, and don't look back as you go. She pointed across the water, and I began to make my way along the soft and sandy beach. She sloshed upward from the lake, and as she took the beach, she said something so startling that I found myself coming to a halt and almost turning around to question her. I'm glad you came, she called after me. I knew you would, but I was beginning to wonder.
She said, call me now, baby, I come up running. She said, call me now, baby, I'd come up running. If you'd call me now, baby, I'd come up running.
I have taken a vow of poverty, the woman said. She had not yet introduced herself, and yet was saying this while setting down what looked to be an expensive bottle of whiskey. She poured the liquor into a black clay coffee cup that looked to be patched with mud. She drank from it, and then passed the cup to me. I smelled the whiskey's silver-cutting surface, and then drank it back. My throat felt a lightning sting, and then turned to gravel. I coughed harshly, which seemed to please her. Moonshine, she said. She hunched over the cup and took several small practiced sips. I guessed that she was in her 50s. Her hair was a blackish grey and kept back in a loose ponytail, and her tanned and well-lined face looked tightened by the weather, strained and webbed with pressures rather than age, as though she'd spent her time in the heavy winds, squinting into the sun. She kicked a wilted cigarette forward from a black pouch. She lit it as I sipped from the cup. There was something deeply vulnerable in her manner that created hesitation on my part, as though anything I said would simply interfere with whatever important revelation she needed to impart. I was there to listen, and she hovered on the edge of her secret. A vow of poverty, she said, starting a list on her fingers. A vow of timelessness. A vow of no names, a vow of loneliness, a vow of living on the lake for the rest of my life, a vow of no favorite baseball team, a vow of chastity, a vow of 2 bottles of moonshine a week and no more, a vow of early to bed, a vow of bathing in the lake every day, even when it's cold, a vow not to hate my brother Dill, but always love him, a vow not to hate my best friend, Anna, but always love her, a vow to never kill them and take their money, a vow not to die at my own hands, a vow never to go back to town or visit the trailer, a vow to do my best to remember and keep all my vows, and a vow to be thankful for what I have, and I think I've forgot some. I suppose that what I was feeling might have been what a priest feels in the confessional. She had created this atmosphere for me, established my attitude as absorbent and non-judging. Normally, I would have been curious about certain of her vows. I would have been ironic, disdainful, damning. But I was not a quotient here, a sum or an end. I was a part of something bigger, something cloudy and vast. So I'm all pinned down, she said, laughing a little. Nothing else left to vow away. I suppose I could stop drinking, but drinking helps me keep a couple of the important vows. Which is why I did the spirit fire and summoned you. She gestured down the peninsula toward the still visible smoke and flames. I don't usually ask for help, but this one has got me and won't let go. She took a big drink now directly from the bottle, and then smoked hard on the cigarette and quickly began to rally back and forth between the whiskey and the smoke. When Dill won the lotto, she said, I came out here. That's when I took the vow of poverty, she said, nodding. The vow of silence came quickly after that, she said, whispering, as though in violating the vow as she was, she felt obliged to at least pay her respects to its inaudible aims. But I have to talk like I have to drink. It gets some of the bad business out. Otherwise, I'd track them down and right in their bed with a knife. She gritted her teeth and stabbed an invisible knife downward, and she shivered over the dream version of the murder. And then her eyes moistened, and she looked expectantly toward me, as though now would be a good time for me to impart my wisdom on the matter. I like whiskey and I like baseball, the woman said in a quick series. She stood from the table and opened the exterior wooden shutter covering the single front window. Behind the shutter, standing on the sill on the inside of the cabin, was a small television. She turned this on, and a moment later, we were drinking whiskey and watching a professional baseball game. I broke off the sound knob, she said. That's as close as I can get to a vow of silence. Though truth is, it drives me crazy not to hear whatever the announcer says. We watched a few quiet innings. She was smoking what I gathered was a handmade cigarette and drinking homemade whiskey, all while watching silent baseball on her mutilated television. It seemed to me a curious and hard contrast of intake and consumerism as against the denials of her vows. There was a kind of torture here, of a thing ripping itself in two directions so as to remain positioned where it was. I've been burning the fire for 2 days, she said. I followed the directions this time. Usually I don't. I don't like to follow orders. The first thing I had to do was find a place on the beach where I felt weak, which I didn't want to do, because I didn't want to feel weak. But it was more important to me this time that I do it right. So I walked around until I found that spot. I just fell down there and cried. So that's where I built the fire. And then I had to find all the things in the forest that felt like me, herbs and flowers and branches and whatever. And that was hard too, because at first nothing felt like me. It was just a bunch of sticks and dirt. And then, after a while, everything felt like me. And then I settled down because this was important, and I found out that it's pine branches and blue jay feathers that are most like me. And so I set all that on fire in the place I was most weak. And then I had to wait, somewhere hard or uncomfortable. I didn't want to go into the water, but I knew right away that's where I had to be. I tried to find another place, up a tree, out in the thorns, but then I remembered. This was important. So I went right out into the water. She paused for a moment before continuing. A fire spirit can be anything. I thought if I was lucky I'd get a bird, maybe a blue jay, because that's my bird spirit. Though usually a message is just a stick falling in the woods, and I never can figure anything out like that. It needs to be words in a sentence, and even then I'm sometimes troubled. Once I got a deer, and that helped, because of the way he didn't rush off when I walked up to him. That showed me no fear, and I needed that. So when I saw you, I thought, oh, maybe he'll just tell me what to do. Just show me the way out of this, and don't just break my cup or throw a rock in the water, and leave it for me to figure out some kind of symbol that you know I'll never understand.
I've been a moonshiner for 17 long years. I've spent all my money on whiskey and beer. I go to some hollow and sit of my still. And if whiskey don't kill me, and I don't know what will. Go to some bar room and drink with my friends, where the women can't follow and see what I spend. God bless them pretty women, I wish they was mine. Their breath is as sweet as the dew on the vine. Let me eat when I'm hungry. Let me drink when I'm dry. Dollars when I'm hard up. Religion. The whole world's a bottle, and life's but a dram. When a bottle gets empty, it sure ain't worth a damn.
We were in the trailer, all together, the woman continued. It was me and my brother Dill, and then my best friend Anna moved in, and we were all close, and they were a couple. I don't know why I couldn't get over it when it happened, and I don't know why it's even worse now. Everything I did was to make it less worse, which is the only reason why I'm here, but the opposite happened. I wanted it to go away, but it's all came here to live, all the bad feelings. They could do what they wanted, and they still can. It was their money, and it still is. But I took care of them, you see. I don't know if they know that, or if they remember something different. That's something I wonder, and want to ask. What do you remember? Because all I know is I worked, and you never worked. So how can you remember different? It was just me bringing home the money, no one else worked. And yes, it was Dill's number that hit. But I stopped at the lottery to pick it up. He picked it out, and I picked it up. I placed that number, she said severely. So it was me working, and they just lived off that, and I didn't mind, and we were fine in a way, though it was hard. Neither of them ever tried for a job. I paid the bills, did the shopping. That's what an older sister does, what a best friend does. But at least they pay the electricity now, and that's what they can do for me, the woman said. She looked up into the sky as though speaking to God. If that's what Dale and Anna can do for their older sister, for their best friend, then that's what they can do, and I am thankful for that, and I thank them. She trailed off. But I still want to kill them and take the money. You know what happened on the day he won? They ran off on me, Dale and Anna, right off into nowhere, because they thought I was going to take the ticket and cash it and keep it for myself. And they were right. That's what I would have done. She put her hands over her face. I mean, I would have been in charge, let's just say that. Not like a thief, because I would have shared it out with them, equal parts. I know that's how I'd do it. Pretty sure, a third each, enough to keep us all happy for the rest of our lives. But I'd be in charge. Do you see what I'm saying? I admit I would have taken it. I would have said it was mine. I picked and placed that number, I would have said. Just because I deserved to hand it out. Do you understand? After all that, I deserved to be in charge. It was Dill that picked it, but it was my money that made it exist, and I placed it at the lottery. So I have these vows for a reason. If I didn't have these vows, I'd be on my way right now to Dill and Anna's with a knife. No question in my mind. A sharp, sharp knife in my strong arms. I'd find them both. I kept you alive. I'd pin them both down. You didn't have anything. I placed that order. It was my dollar and my work, and I was the one carried it home. Even if I wasn't a good person and irritable, that's how an older sister is, or a best friend. I was always tired. You know I would have shared it out, equal parts. But why didn't they? It's not understandable. Don't they remember how I took care of them? So that's why I called you. Because I can feel I'm off soon with the knife, and there's no vow that can stop it. But maybe you can, which is why I did the fire. Because of her confessional tones and perception of me as a kind of astral spirit, a guide summoned by her fire to help her find some way to not attack her now wealthy and seemingly ungrateful brother and former best friend, I had entered into a kind of dreamy quiescence. I hadn't spoken and had become like a stick floating on a quiet pond. And obviously, I was drunk on the homemade liquor. And not just normal drunk. Bizarrely, keenly, stars and rainbows drunk. My eyes were swimming and separately following their own interests. I felt drugged, and my mind was flowing deeply along the emotional canyon the woman carved out with her story. I felt her brutal anger. I felt a murderous impulse. Yes, I thought, we could go in the night with knives and find this Dill and this Anna, and we would set upon them over their pillows, and find the justice in their removal. but to make it clear to them first, to explain their damage. For this woman, your sister, she cared for you, your best friend, and she would have shared with you. It was her that bought the ticket and carried it home, and now look what you've brought upon yourselves for not being gracious. And then again, over and within that, a spirit of forgiveness and tenderness that simply gathered toward the woman in deep pain and felt the suffering aside from its cause as a raw and bleeding and unhealing wound. Although I was flattered to be misrepresented as a kind of spirit healer, I also felt the con man's shame. For I was mostly pretending to be the thing that she wanted. Although I was curious of her story, I was not deeply committed to my role, and for that reason I felt sorry that she had a charlatan where a stick falling in the woods might have done a better job. Thus it was that I felt a measure of excitement and relief when I saw, with my inebriated vision, down near the now smoking fire, a brown and furry face poking from the woods and sniffing upwards into the air. The bear strolled out and then sat back beside the fire, evaluating it. I stared at it in wonder, and then, like a bad news oracle in an old-fashioned movie, I raised one long bony finger and pointed toward the bear at the fire. As the woman continued her confession, I watched as her eyes relocated and fixed upon my pointing finger, but she did not turn to follow the place of indication. She did not see the bear. I should have broken the spell right there, pointed to the bear and said, "There is your spirit guide, my dear, not me. I am an impostor. Go to your bear and see what he has to say." But something powerful smothered me into silence. At the moment, I blamed both my vanity and my drunkenness. I had never before been mistaken as a holy man, and it felt comfortable and made me serene and happy. And yet, as though I might say in court that I tried to tell her of her bear, I kept my finger poised and stretched and pointing toward the bear, who was now laying down beside the fire. As I reached once more for the clay cup of moonshine, I was stunned by an incoming, mad blue flutter, and further shocked when some tight roughness took hold of my outstretched finger. The woman gasped and looked for a moment to be choking. My groggy displacement was slow to recognize that upon my pointing finger was now perched the flinty blue and white figure of a blue jay.
Lady bird sat on me and I know if thou stays when I finish me rhyme. Whatever it is I command, whatever I'm wishing for soon will be mine. In our house there's no din, I wish there were somebody in. Lady bird, fly away warm. The house is on fire, the childer is gone.
I was not there, but watching from a distance sideways, as though behind the trees or in the forest. The figure strolled along the beach, with the blue jay fixed on his outstretched finger, its wings flapping as though it were flying through the middle sky. And the woman followed behind, and as they got to the fire extinguished, and a raspy, dirty black flower of smoke rose into the sky. And the bear stood and pushed into the brush, and the man with the bird followed him into the woods, and was followed by the woman. And I darted away to watch from my many other places as the night fell down and the sky filled up with tiny, sparkling shines of gold. There were moments when I blended back into my walking self, and when I was there, I simply stared at the bird and felt the air blow down from its striking wings and watched its wild eyes for signs of our arrival. Was it the moonshine that was acting on me, giving me this ghost walker's vision, or the bird, or my fatigue, or some scratching, poisonous nettle in the woods? I was talking, too, out loud, in a language deeply private and convivial, and we were following after the bear, whose steps were ponderous and slow, and yet somehow he was much swifter than us, and then the bear was gone, and the bird began to struggle on the outstretched finger, as though before it was a convenient, an easy cargo, my body, but now it had grown tired of dragging such a load, and above us the stars seemed to pack into themselves and die. The gold became silver, and the silver chalk, and the chalk turned to a spectral dust, and we were walking in blackness. But yet the bird kept flying and taking us along. There came a cool and open dark stretch, and there again was the bear, lain down and sleeping in the shadows of a long, well-maintained yard, full of well-placed rocks, exotic trees, and heavy, delicate fountains. We went to the bear and could smell its mountainous odor of trees and hunger and mud, and the bird urged us forward, for cradled in the center of the estate, in a golden glitter, was a home of glass and sharp-reaching peaks. A moment later, in the quiet recess behind a decorative boulder, we were looking through a sailor's glass window at a man and a woman quietly watching a very large television, purchased, I imagined, by means of their lottery winnings. The same baseball game that we had watched at the cabin was playing here now, and the woman leaned in upon me in the cool air, watching her brother and her former best friend, a happy-looking couple now, as against the window we could hear the dull drone of the announcer's voice calling the game. The blue jay folded its wings into a blade in the darkness and grew hard in my hand and became the shape of a knife. I handed it to her, and she stood forward in the yard and crept closer and closer to the window and went down on her shins and knees in the fresh bark mulch. And between the rhododendron and the dwarfed pine, she shuffled in, and the knife fell upwards from her hands in a burst of wings as she pressed up against the glass, and the blue jay shot into the sky, and the bear rolled off into the woods, and the man and the woman, Dill and Anna, turned slowly from their game to examine the damaged figure at their window as my fingers turned the keys of the ignition of my car, and I was driving back home down the quiet, quiet road. Adams, Motion, and the Void.